Sam's friend, Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, here on a Saturday, special Saturday session of the program in our undisclosed location deep behind the orange curtain. Yes, I'm sorry we're doing it today. The show normally is finished, completed in the can by the end of the work week. But this week I was traveling, and as a consequence, could not get behind the microphone here with producer Robbie to deliver radio excellence for all of you good people out there. Now, a few extra days also means a few extra topics to cover, as we have a full week to analyze, dissect, and hand-wring over. I'm going to start, forgive me here for a minute. I'm warning you. I'm putting out a Sam Nation Sturgeon general warning. You may not like what I say. And all I ask is that you just not turn me off as I say it. Okay. I think that this indictment against Assange, Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, is just crap. Now, I'm not just talking as a lawyer. I'm also talking as a constitutionalist, somebody who believes in civil liberties. And I, you know, I sit here every day, every week, every month, every year, listening to absolute terrible things being said in the media that are wrong, that are deliberately, in my view, deceitful. The media. Each and every one of us, we all have the right to speak freely. Now, every thought, and this is really important, because what Assange is being charged with is a criminal conspiracy to release information that was classified. Now, I will tell you this I want you to think about this and keep an open mind. Every bit of knowledge that you and I have came from somewhere, right? If you have a particular belief or know a particular fact, you weren't just born with it, right? I mean, it was something that through experience, through you reading a book or reading something online, you formed knowledge, you retained facts. And you developed opinion. Now, if you read a book by, let's say, Noam Chomsky, and Chomsky, God forbid, influences you to have some really whacked out ideas about the world, you and him did not enter into a criminal conspiracy or a left-wing fanatical conspiracy to have particular ideas. This is an important point, because what happened here is Chelsea Manning had a bunch of documents related to Bush-era war crimes in Iraq. And she, what she did is she went on made contact with WikiLeaks. And WikiLeaks had already been around for a while and had a couple of other, I think, less important revelations, some scandals in Europe, things like that. And so she goes on there and she makes contact with them. And gives them some information. Now, after she gives them some information, I don't care if you're the New York Times or the Washington Post, whoever, anybody, any reporter, any journalist who goes on there and gets a source and the source starts giving them information, what are you going to say to the source? You're going to say, give me more. And this is no different than you or I reading something that we find interesting and now suddenly being told, don't inquire. The government can't control that. They want to, because here we're dealing with classified information. I'm not disputing. The crime is the person releasing the information. But you don't become a co-conspirator in the release of information just because you get a phone call and you publish something. And by the way, the courts have already ruled on this, and they ruled on it back in the 1960s with the Pentagon Papers. The New York Times was approached by a guy who was an analyst with the Rand Corporation, and he'd The RAND Corporation been retained by Robert McNamara, who was the defense secretary, and came out with an absolute devastating report that showed how terribly the war was going and how the American public had been lied to. And the particular analyst that had drafted the report sent it to the New York Times because, of course, you know, he was appalled by it. Now, the New York Times and the Washington Post, the two papers I think that had the Pentagon Papers, wanted to publish it. And the government came in and sought an injunction against the publication. And the Supreme Court decided, no, First Amendment bars, right, prevents the government from restricting speech. And it doesn't matter, the genesis of the material doesn't matter. So the indictment, as I read it, now, most of it deals with the criminal conspiracy. There's a part of it that has to deal that alleges, and it's just a few lines in there, very flimsy, alleges that somehow Assange was himself trying to help Chelsea Manning crack a code. There's a password that she didn't have, apparently, in order to get more information. Now, you can't do that. So if you're a reporter or you're Robbie Hagland, you cannot go and crack codes. And so you can publish. You can't do that. Those are very separate crimes. But as far as publishing, and I see in this, by the way, I'm always fascinated by the media reactions. So the media reaction to all of this is, you know, hang him up, truss him up. And this is why when I, you know, am telling friends and family as I've been watching this, I said, oh, this is a slippery slope. Don't get anywhere near it. And I'm getting a lot of pushback. And it's because there is a near unanimous voice right now from all the pundits out there on all the networks, Fox and CNN and MSNBC. And what are they all saying? They're all saying, yeah, this guy, lock him up and throw away the key. The reason they're all saying this, by the way, is because I'm not just talking about the media people, but I'm also talking about all the contributors that are on these programs. These are all insiders from either the Bush era, Obama era, Clinton era. I mean, these are all Washington insiders. These are establishment swamp monsters. And WikiLeaks, well, WikiLeaks was a great darling of the left, right? Remember when WikiLeaks published stuff about Bush doing bad things in Iraq, and it was just like, oh, yes, Assange. And every actor and actress and liberal, rich, busybody up and down, they all just, oh, Assange, oh, my goodness, mon ami. And then what happened? Assange decided to publish the emails from the DNC and from Hillary Clinton conspiring to steal the election away from Bernie. And then he pissed off the entire Clinton DNC apparatus and made mortal enemies among that section of the political class. Well, I hate to run some simple math for you folks, but if the pie is 100% and you take all the Bush neocons and put them, you know, and add them to all the Obama, you know, lib people, and you add to that the Clinton folks. How much of the pie, Robbie, quick math, how much of the pie, do you think that's 80% of the pie? Maybe more, 70, 80? Folks, it's a lot of pie. This is a problem, and this is why, and I always say this, if you are a patient, steady, faithful listener of this program, you'll know that I tell you, get worried and be very skeptical when everyone agrees. Whenever there is mass agreement on a topic, make sure your own antenna go up. I think that that's part of the other part of this, of course. I mean, again, the media themselves think of themselves as the only holder of journalistic protections, and that, you know, they look at the decision New York Times versus United States for the Pentagon Papers, and they look at that and they say, well, but that's the New York Times. I mean, we're the New York Times. We're legitimate journalists. And WikiLeaks, this is, you know, this is an online portal, and it's this kooky guy, Assange, and, you know, there's some stories about him smearing his feces on the wall of the embassy. I mean, that's not who, that's not who we are. That's not the same thing. Apples and oranges. Well, let me tell you, the First Amendment is not some special protection for registered journalists. The First Amendment applies to them. It applies to you. It applies to me. Applies to all of us. By the way, there in the Constitution, nor under the law, there are no special protections for journalists. That is a giant misnomer, and I think it's created because journalists always say, "Oh, I'm a journalist. You can't hold me in contempt. You can't." Yeah, well, sorry, we can. It's just traditionally not done. But in this particular case, journalists can share what they've learned from a source. The Supreme Court back in the 60s didn't want to touch it, and I doubt necessarily that they would want to touch it now. Of course, they might, you know, because now there's the second part of this is not a legal thing. It's a political matter. I don't know what happened to Assange's cat. You know this. He had a cat in the embassy. Yes. So when he was hauled out of there, by the way, did you see how old he looked? Oh, my gosh. I mean, he went in as a kind of young silver fox, if you will. Kind of Anderson Cooper-esque almost in a Eurotrash way. And then comes out of it looking like Father Time. I mean, the man's almost bald. He's got this big beard. So he had a cat in the embassy. He named that cat Catstro in homage to one Fidel Castro of Cuba. The cat had 31,000 Twitter followers. And I listed as one of its activities, counter-prevalence. The folks, the Ecuadorians in the embassy, by the way, did you see this? They were worried that they started restricting the cat's access. There's two different stories. One, that they locked the cat into the same room with Assange. And the other part of it, they threw it out a window. But the reason for this was that they thought that the cat had a camera on its collar and was recording them. Bizarre stuff. Separate all of this from the legality of it. And let me tell you something. Our founding fathers, when they put in the First Amendment, you think that journalism was pure back then? You think that 18th century journalists, these were some of the sleaziest, nastiest, most awfully factually and fake news, right? This is not a new thing. Journalism at the inception of our republic was awful. And if our founders wanted to write special protections for registered journalists, they would have done so. But they gave everyone blanket freedoms, and that is in order for our republic, in order to survive. More daylight, the better. Let bad ideas out there and let them fail. And certainly, once things of newsworthy items get into our public discourse, leak into our public stream of commerce, if you will, these things ought to be discussed. And certainly no injunctions or preventions of it being released ought to be imposed by the government. So we will follow this story closely and get to you with any updates. Send me email, sam@samnation.com. I know you probably feel differently about this, and I look forward to hearing from you. All right, back right after this. Lots going on in D.C. too. Oh, my goodness. Is Nancy Pelosi in control? I don't know. Sam Rogowski back right after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Sam Rzhovsky. Okay, Liz Cheney has declared that Nancy Pelosi is not in control of her caucus. Well, yeah. Of course she's not in control. Let me tell you, I know this to be a fact, that when Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer, right, her number two right-hand man on the Democratic side of the House of Representatives, when they are alone talking in a room, they do not have good things to say about AOC. They do not have good things to say about Ilhan Omar. And they do not have good things to say about a number of individual, more left-wing, radical, socialist members of Congress that were elected in this last wave. Now, let me tell you the reason why AOC, for example, got elected in the first place is because, and this is a little technical and wonky, but you got to understand what's going on behind the scenes. The Democratic Party, and specifically the DCCC, which is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. This is the super PAC that funds the individual House campaigns, is getting an enormous amount of hate right now from establishment Democrats that they allowed these runaway trains to leave the station. The DCCC was so busy focused, the Democrats all were, too busy focused on winning the House and hating on Trump, that they weren't paying attention to these upstart nincompoops that were coming into districts. Like AOC unseated a 20-year veteran. Remember this. Joseph Crowley, who was a ranking member, right? It was a seniority, very important on Capitol Hill. Seniority gets you posts. So even when you're out of power, these are people who reliably end up on committees and can shape agenda and messaging. There's nothing AOC is doing to contribute to party messaging. AOC is doing messaging for AOC. She's not towing in any way the Democratic Party line. And so the DCCC, you've got a lot of Democrats going to the DCCC. What the F did you do to, why did you let all these challengers come up through the races? Why didn't you allocate enough dollars to protect our incumbents? So to wit, there is now a movement, and this is this is being written about a little bit out there in the news, is that there's now a blacklist. Now, what's the blacklist about? It's not a candidate blacklist. It's a vendor blacklist. And so what the DCCC has come out and said, they said, look, enough of this BS with primary challenges. We don't want any more AOC junior wannabes going to reliably Democratic districts and fighting primaries and potentially winning and unseating, well, we'll say more establishment, toe-the-line Democrats. So what we're going to do, there's a blacklist, and if you're a vendor, right, and every campaign relies on vendors, who are vendors? I mean, yeah, anyone from people doing polling, from people doing canvassing, voter, like every company, every person, campaign managers and the like that get hired on by campaigns or get work outsourced to during campaigns. Any vendor that takes dollars and does work for primary challengers of incumbent Democrats, that's it. You're done. You're on the blacklist. You're not going anywhere. It's actually very effective because the dollars spent right in a primary are far less than the dollars spent in the general. So the real money, the real, I guess, the real prize, if you will, for any vendor, anybody working on a campaign, is the general election. You do the primary. Hopefully you pick the right candidate. So then you get, you know, you get on as working in the general. And all the money, right? In any election, if you're the candidate, you raise maybe $500,000, $1.5 million. And in a tough race, it's the DCCC that comes in and puts millions of other dollars behind you. You cannot do this without the DCCC. But when we come back, there's more to the story that I have learned than is being reported. And I think we'll see some whisperings of this in the coming weeks. So don't go anywhere. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Sam Rojosky, Sam Nation on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Majowski. You'll find him very interesting. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Yes, 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 I'm here. Don't worry, I'm just drinking a little coffee. I gotta get myself up and at it here on this Saturday morning. Yeah, so have you heard the latest pronouncement from Ilhan Omar, who is one of these new upstart Democrats that was elected to Congress in the anti-Trump wave? You know, she's, I think, now one of two Muslim women in Congress, the other one being Rashida Tlaib, yeah. Now, Rashida Tlaib, at least all she did was she got up there and said, you know what, you know, F Trump or whatever it was. Okay. But Ilhan Omar takes all of this to the next level. The comments everybody's talking about this week is her speaking at a CARE banquet. And the comments just emerged this week. This happened in late March. And these were her 9/11 comments. I'm sure you've heard some rumblings about this. Now, CARE is the Council on American Islamic Relations. They are basically a giant PR group in America that is funded through donations, also has some external funding from outside of the United States, and also has provided funding in turn and was an unindicted conspirator in funneling charity money to fund terrorism activities of Hamas. So not a group exactly without any controversy. Nonetheless, Ilhan Omar is speaking to them, and here are her comments on 9/11.
Far too long, we have lived with the discomfort of being a second-class citizen. And frankly, I'm tired of it, and every single Muslim in this country should be tired of it. CARE was founded after 9/11 because they recognized that some people did something and that all of us were starting to lose access to our civil liberties.
Oh, my goodness. So that is the some people did something. I guess by this standard, Julian Assange did nothing. But more importantly, you can hear the vitriol, but this is not an on script Nancy Pelosi keeping her caucus in line message, is it? And Ilhan Omar now has a long history of pronouncements of anti-Israel sentiments, certainly anti-Semitic sentiments and things like this that she's said. So here's what I sense is happening with Ilhan Omar. I suspect that when the DCCC comes out there and says, we are blacklisting vendors who work or take work to oppose incumbents, I would suggest to you folks that the word incumbent is being used very loosely by the DCCC, in fact, by the whole Democratic Party. And I doubt that AOC and certainly not Ilhan Omar are going to be viewed necessarily as incumbents. And expect, I am telling you, expect for a vigorous effort by the Democratic Party to unseat these ladies. Because I'm telling you, you can be 29 or whatever, however old Ilhan Omar is, and you can, I guess all you need is the support of your district. I mean, if your district loves what you're saying and thinks that, you know, some people did some stuff on September 11th, no big deal, you know, oops. And by the way, it just, you know, it really just, then they just came after us, right? They just came after us after that. But you're not going to get any. Nancy Pelosi is a political animal with hundreds of millions of dollars behind her, and I expect the Democratic Party to flex his muscle. And this is what I believe is happening as we speak right now. So don't the story that it's all about protecting incumbents. The incumbents, not all the incumbents are going to get protected here. Not all the incumbents will be spared in primaries coming up. So, all right. We'll see if that works out. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Another part of the story that I think is interesting is how the comments, Ilhan Omar's comments, are being reported on in the mainstream media. You know Dan Crenshaw, the Republican congressman from Texas? Right, he's the guy with the eye patch, got into a tiff with Pete Davidson on SNL. That guy. So he puts out a tweet calling Ilhan Omar's comments unbelievable. First member of Congress to ever describe terrorists who killed thousands of Americans on 9/11 as, quote, some people who did something, close quote. Crenshaw of Texas wrote in a tweet. Here is Joe Scarborough on Morning Joe talking with Willie Geist about this reaction, right, about Dan Crenshaw's tweet and his take on this. I think this is so fascinating. Have a listen.
Dan Crenshaw did a great job reaching out to the SNL.
Pete Davidson.
Pete Davidson.
Yeah.
And he was tweeting about this yesterday. I didn't quite understand that because he works with her. Walk across the aisle and just sit down. It's so important, I think, personally, for her to succeed. Right. She's there have been some missteps, but there's something much bigger here, like going on. Like, we don't want one of our first Muslim women, Americans, to blow up politically like this. And I just wish you'd walk across the aisle and go, hey, let me tell you, this is why this is going to be offensive to some people. And I understand how you feel about Israel, but just can we just talk regularly about this?
And then maybe he can tweet, we just had a talk.
Yeah.
What? What the hell? First of all, you know, and this, by the way, right here, you understand why the Democratic Party and why the left is so obsessed with identity politics, why identity to them matters infinitely more than substance. We've talked about this ad nauseum. It's so important, I think, says Joe Scarborough, for her to succeed. Right, right, right. Why? Why is it important for her to succeed? She's a bigot. She is a Muslim bigot. Let those words sink in. Second, she's an extremist. These people lecture us for days on end about extremism, about radicalism, about all those Trump supporters out there that hate people of color, that are white nationalists, that don't even deserve a place in our society. And they are literally right here covering for a sitting member of Congress who is who holds despicable beliefs. See, when I tell you about how much I love the First Amendment, you know why I love the First Amendment? I love the First Amendment because a sick bigot like Ilhan Omar can say these things. I can play them for you, and we can, well, I wish we could laugh at it, but certainly we can take it apart, and we can criticize it, and we can reveal the true extent of her insanity. I'm being charitable calling it insanity, by the way. So then, you know, in this segment, Joe Scarborough says, well, yeah, there have been some missteps. Yeah, you think? But there's something bigger going on here. And this is it. Right here's the tell. There's something bigger going on. Because in identity politics, it's never about the individual. For liberals, they never care about the individual. It's the collective. And the collective here is diversity. That's what's more important than the substance of any of this. Here the quote continues. We don't want one of our first Muslim women, Americans, to blow up like this. Why not? She deserves to blow up. And by the way, is that a bad choice of words? I don't know. Kara might come along and have something to say about that. But anyway. And then, of course, the absurdity, right, that it's the responsibility of Dan Crenshaw, a Republican, to walk across the aisle and say, hey, yo, colleague, you've lost your marbles. What the F are you saying? Maybe you need to tone it down a little bit and save your career. Since when is it the responsibility of the opposition to help, calm the you-know-whatsies of a political opponent? This is like, can you imagine Joe Scarborough saying, you know, really, I really think Nancy Pelosi should just talk a little bit to Trump. I mean, we don't want our first orange industrialist land developer to blow up like this. We really need to have Nancy really ought to sit and talk to him. Never, ever, and this is a rule, never, ever formulate a logical or illogical thought that you can't then take that same logic, turn it around, and use it in the opposite. You just, this is so dumb, but it's actually not dumb. It reveals exactly what the left is all about. And to them, her identity as a Muslim woman trumps all. So they can't defend it, right? They can't defend what she's saying. But instead, they defend her only on the basis of who she is, on the basis of some identity. And remember, this idiotic woman wrote a letter to a judge asking leniency for ISIS recruits. I mean, she's a terrorist sympathizer. I don't know how else to put it. And she's in Congress. And Trump is a criminal? Give me a flippin' break. Sam Rogowski, back after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rogowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation. I just want to make a quick point here about Politico. You know Politico, they, you know, online do-rag of the Democratic Party collective. Look, Politico put a piece out there. Holly Otterbein wrote it. I believe that's how we pronounce her name. When the GOP tried and failed, that's the operative part of the title, to tag Democrats as socialists. And it talks about the midterms. It talks about how the Republicans in many of these districts ran against socialism, said, whoa, socialists over there. AOC is a socialist. It didn't work. And then this piece goes on as sort of a, I don't know, some sort of odd diatribe about how this is a cautionary tale and it's not going to work in 2020. Hear me out. And as it specifically relates to this Green New Deal that AOC is pushing, by the way, Mitch McConnell put it on a vote in the Senate chamber. No one voted for it. Not one Democratic senator would be willing to put their name to it. Markey, did he even vote for it? The co-sponsor? He didn't even vote for it. Here's my point. You're going to hear a lot of noise about this. The left is going to say, oh, this socialist smear doesn't work. Millennials love socialism. You know, they love living off their parents and paying no rent and blah, blah, blah. But this, let's just say it's all true and it didn't work in the midterms. That's before we got a full taste of their lunacy. That's before these people had a chance to talk as members of Congress, and we disregarded them in a fractious election that was really focusing on a referendum, yay Trump, nay Trump, right? Now the Democratic Party, what is it? Who's getting all the press? Alexandria Ocasio's getting all the press. Ilhan Omar's getting all the press. You think Ben McAdams is getting any press? I had a look. I had a look at the Salt Lake Tribune here to get this piece. Normally a Republican idea, Utah's Democratic Representative Ben McAdams proposes a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. Yes! Yes, there is a Democrat I can get behind. Did that get any press? Nope. Newt. Do you see my point? Liz Cheney is right. Nancy Pelosi has lost control of her caucus. And believe me, she knows it, and she's too able of a political operator to let it go. So, the takeaways here are Politico is once again living in fantasy land because now the American public, you really think you're going to win over heartland voters with some people did some things on 9/11? Yeah, that's a non-starter. The fractured relationship between Jewish Americans and the Democratic Party is getting worse and not better. Those voters defected en masse to Trump in 2016, and they defected because of Obama's equivocation on matters of Israel, on matters of terrorism, on matters of Muslim extremism. Don't doubt me on this for 1 minute. And that's only getting worse. Socialism in the heartland? Tell me more. Yeah, I'll see it when I'll see that idea winning over, especially when it's being touted in such childish and amateurish terms as AOC's new Green Deal. And then finally, because Nancy's a shrewd operator, expect these people to be on a hit list. The blacklist really isn't about vendors. The blacklist is about getting to the candidates themselves and ruining these extremists. And by this is going to watch. You wait and see. It's an existential struggle for the soul of the Democratic Party. And it's not like it's not like Trump versus establishment GOP. That's a very different fight. Because Trump won the presidency. He is the de facto leader of the party. He installs the Democratic RNC chair. He is the boss. These guys and gals, these are all junior members of Congress. So the DCCC, they're going to fund campaigns like Ben McAdams, who are middle of the road candidates, who are, even though they're blue dogs and they don't go up with everything that Pelosi says, are not an embarrassment or a thorn in her side. Mark my words on this. All right, when we come back, let me fill you in on what you need to know about Attorney General Bill Barr's testimony in Congress and about what this Mueller probe really is going to mean for the next 12 to 24 months moving forward. Spoiler alert, it's not good for Democrats. Sam Murjofsky, stay tuned.
We shall fight on the airwaves. We shall fight on Twitter and Facebook. We shall broadcast our program, whatever the cost may be. And if Sam Nation lasts for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour.
Sam Murjofsky here at Sam Nation, making radio great again. All right. Bill Barr this week, the Attorney General, on Capitol Hill testifying. Ostensibly, this was all about the Mueller report, the redactions, and how and when the report would be at least provided, if not made public, provided to members of the House and Senate. So, of course, as per usual, the Democratic political class is making this about something that it isn't. And it's at their peril. Let me explain. They are making today's fight about releasing the Mueller report, releasing Trump's taxes, keeping the pressure on about collusion, when we've just had a multi-million dollar effort led by, according to them, a dispassionate legal eagle, Bob Mueller, that for 2 years has been looking at everything and anything possibly related to this and has not issued any indictments. At least not any indictments of Trump's inner circle that go to the issue of collusion or even of obstruction of justice. Now, I say all of this because I think that this is sort of the dead horse that is being beaten, flogged in the proverbial town square. The horse is dead. Collusion, it ain't there. If it were, Washington is a place full of leaks. I don't care if this report were seen by, I don't know, five people, let alone the 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 that have seen it. If Barr had written a letter to Congress that said there's no collusion and no conclusions on obstruction of justice, and it turned out, and the report actually has something of that nature, trust me, we would know all about it by now. It was Barr's testimony about spying, well, surveillance of the Trump campaign that really tells us, it foreshadows what the next chapter of the saga is going to be, and rightfully so. And all of the pontificators, all of the people, the wise men who were the darlings, well, still are the darlings of the left-wing media, like Clapper and Comey and who else? Brennan, don't forget Brennan. John Brennan. These guys, they're going down. And let me tell you why. Barr is not, I got to step back from this a little bit. Trump doesn't always pick the right people. It's a terrible flaw of his. And I just don't get it. I know in any organization, occasionally you put the wrong person in a job. And you realize it, and you have to get rid of them. And I know. They say you can, if you do your homework right as an employer, you will always put the right person in the right job. I don't know, but Trump has the number of times he's put forward people who just are not that qualified. Barr is not an ideologue. He's not a Trumpian guy. If anything, he's gotten kind of a swamp creature in his own right. He comes from within the system. He served during the Bush administration. Okay, I'm very suspicious of all these holdovers. I'm very, very suspicious and was not the least bit enthused about his appointment when it happened. What I find fascinating is now the media trying to point or paint Barr into something or make him into something that he's not, to wit, this Daily Beast put out a article the 2 days, one day ago, 2 days ago. Bill Barr is the most dangerous man in America, and talked about how every, you know, despot, you know, who's out there, firebrand despot, who's moving the crowds and inciting hatred and the like, read Donald Trump, needs to support him in his evil enterprise, a faithful, diligent public servant who is unassuming, cold, calculating, and is turning the wheels of bureaucracy to help and assist Trump. The left is delusional. If they actually, who wrote this article? Rick Wilson. Rick, you're delusional. If you actually believe any of it, that what you wrote, that the exact opposite is true. Trump's out there trying to burn the swamp down, right? And the wheels of the bureaucracy of statism are not working with him. They're working in direct opposition to him. And so he has an attorney general who, from my take on this right now, is that Barr is a call it as you see it kind of guy. That he is an attorney first and a registered Republican, Democrat, independent, whatever he is, second. And I say that because of this exchange with Senator Gene Shaheen, Democrat, New Hampshire, related to spying on the Trump campaign. This is on Wednesday. Listen to this very closely.
I am going to be reviewing both the genesis and the conduct of intelligence activities directed at the Trump campaign.
And can you share with us why you feel a need to do that?
Well, for the same reason we're worried about foreign influence in elections. We want to make sure that during an election, I think spying on a political campaign is a big deal. It's a big deal. Generation I grew up in, which was the Vietnam War, you know, people were all concerned about spying on anti-war people and so forth by the government. And there were a lot of rules put in place to make sure that there's an adequate basis before our law enforcement agencies get involved in political surveillance. I'm not suggesting that those rules were violated, but I think it's important to look at that.
So you're not suggesting, though, that spying occurred?
I guess you could. I think there was a spying did occur. Yes, I think spying did occur.
Well, let me.
But the question is whether it was adequately predicated. And I'm not suggesting it wasn't adequately predicated, but I'd need to explore that. I think it's my obligation. Congress is usually very concerned about intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies staying in their proper lane. And I want to make sure that happened.
I have said from day one that if the roles were reversed in all of this, right, if this was a Republican administration, an outgoing Republican administration, where there was an anointed Republican heir, right, in this case, it was a Democratic heir apparent, Hillary Rodham Clinton. But if there were a Republican heir apparent running against a Democratic opponent, a Democratic outsider, somebody who had taken the Democratic Party by storm, and we Republicans had spied on that Democrat. Can you imagine? I mean, every head that needed to roll would have already rolled by now. Every time you hear a Democratic Party operative, whether it be an elected member of Congress, of the Senate, a TV personality, a reporter, talking about collusion, you've got to know something, okay? You've got to know that is a deliberate effort to push the ball down the road, keep the story on collusion and away from surveillance activities in the Trump campaign. Barr is not the kind of guy that says something without meaning it. Barr is not the kind of guy to take, let's say, a specific order from Trump. This is what people say. You know, by the way, that his wife and Bob Mueller's wife are in a Bible study group together. I mean, that, you know, that freaks me out, actually. I to me, that is, you know, that's right. They're just they're people of Washington. Anybody who's involved at any political level who is a permanent resident of Washington, D.C. or its environs really worries me. Right. This is not a Rudy Giuliani as attorney general testifying. This is not a Chris Christie. This is not a politician turned attorney general. This is a guy who is calling it as he sees it. Later on Wednesday, Lindsey Graham interviewed Bill Barr, and this is the exchange that the two of them had.
A counterintelligence investigation is designed to protect the target of foreign influence. Is that correct?
That is correct.
It's not a prosecutorial function, is it?
No, unless espionage or some violation of espionage laws is develops.
So would it be odd that the candidate was never really briefed by the Department of Justice that your campaign may be targeted by a foreign entity?
That is one of the questions I have I feel normally the campaign would have been advised of this.
Okay. And can you think of a good reason right now why they wouldn't have been?
I'm interested in getting that answer. They had two former U.S. attorneys in Chris Christie and Rudy Giuliani involved in the campaign, and I don't understand why the campaign was not advised.
Yes! So let me translate what this is in case you got lost in all of this. Graham, who is a seasoned prosecutor, understands how these things work. He says, look, a counterintelligence investigation is designed to protect the target of that foreign interference or influence. What does that mean? That means that if you are working on a campaign or the candidate himself, right? If you're that person, then what you, let's say some information comes up that a foreign power is trying to influence you. The people investigating need to go to the candidate and say, hey, you got a problem here. These guys are trying to infiltrate your campaign. They're trying to figure things out. They're trying to get to you. And you warn them in order to protect the candidate, to protect the campaign, and to protect the integrity of our political process. And that didn't happen here. And do you know why? Because the whole thing was a setup from top to bottom. The entire operation, the entire basis for every warrant, from the FISA applications to the physical search warrants to investigating all the different, you know, third, fourth, fifth, 12th man down on the totem pole, all of that that was done by the FBI was a scam. It was a scam because if it were real, and if the concern really were that Russia was trying to infiltrate the election, excuse me, then what would they would have done that? And I even like the line. It's not a throwaway line here about Chris Christie and Rudy Giuliani, whom I mentioned earlier. I mean, they are former U.S. attorneys. What does that mean? That means they're federal prosecutors, they're retired federal prosecutors. They are retired agents, if you will, of the government. They are retired members of the Justice Department. That is not a small function. And those, regardless of their political activities or political affiliations, are people that certainly are not and nor were ever suspected of cooperating or dealing in some backroom deal with Russia. It's a joke. And they were never contacted. And Bill Barr says, yeah, I want to get to the bottom of that. Yeah, no crap. Because when you get to the bottom of it, you're going to find a giant stinking cesspool of nada. Now, I also want to just humorously here point out that now finally serious people on the record are hearing testimony and are testifying, right, about what? The spying that occurred on the Trump campaign. Let's go back to March to September of 2017. MSNBC, CNN, and ABC saying all of these lovely clips.
So I don't think they're taking seriously enough how devastating this is to the American system for one president to say, my predecessor wiretapped.
John? There is no evidence that Donald Trump was wiretapped by Barack Obama. It was and continues to be a lie.
Our conspiracy theory president is at it again. And whenever something like this happens, I wonder, what are the president's sources of information? Where is he getting these ideas?
And that has been denied by President Obama, by the former director of national intelligence, and now we know as well by the FBI director. They are all saying it did not happen. So is the president calling all three of those individuals liars?
Yes, he is. James Clapper, James Comey, President Obama, liars, liars, pants on fire. And by the way, the more they attack Trump when he's right and then proven to be right, the less credibility they have. And also, all this has done is lowered the expectations for Trump with everybody, because they've been busy calling him a liar and an idiot and nincompoop. Conspiracy theory president. And what of it? Then when he's proven right, then when the Clinton Obama, you know, whole little criminal enterprise here begins to come apart and indictments come raining down. Yeah, we'll see how this looks for Trump. So this, all of this here, let me distill it in one simple phrase. 4 more years. Sam Rogowski, back right after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Let's do another then and now, shall we? So Clapper, you know, this was on The View back in 2018, talking with Joy Behar. And Clapper absolutely, vehemently denies the FBI was spying on Trump. Listen.
Trump tweeted that the spying that he claims is spying, other people say it's a whistleblower or an informant. He says it's spying, is bigger than Watergate. So I ask you, was the FBI spying on Trump's campaign?
No, they were not. They were spying on a term I don't particularly like, but on what the Russians were doing, trying to understand, were the Russians infiltrating, trying to gain access, trying to gain leverage and influence.
So like if the worst mother-in-law and the worst ex-wife could get together and have like a little like a Quasimodo baby. It'd be Joy Behar. Anyway, so you hear him back in 2018, not a long time ago, folks, denying, no, they were spying on the Ruskies. The Ruskies, that's who they were spying. I don't even like that term. What do you mean? You don't like the term. Okay. All right there. So here's Clapper on Thursday speaking with Allison Camerota.
Should the campaign have known that there was an investigation, possibly a counterintelligence investigation involving some people connected to the campaign?
Well, I can't speak specifically, Allison, to what the FBI did. I believe, but I don't know for sure, but I believe they did give kind of standard defensive briefings after the candidates were designated after their respective conventions.
But they were spying on Trump before, first of all. And by the way, didn't back just a year ago, right? May of 2018, a year ago, Clapper gets specifically asked, was the FBI spying on Trump? No, they were not. And so here, hey, there's a Allison Camerota already accepts that there was a counterintelligence investigation involving some people connected to the campaign. But some people, by the way, were in Trump Tower, right? Had offices in Trump Tower, had their phones in Trump Tower. Should the campaign have known? Should they have been told? Well, I can't. Here's Clapper now. I can't speak specifically, Allison, to anything that the FBI did. Huh? This thing stinks to high heaven. And looking at it as an attorney, looking at it as a fact seeker, and trying to fit these facts into any number of legal theories that spell, you know, 20 to 30 years in the big house for some of these people. Yeah. Uh-huh. I see it. So stay tuned to this story. This is where it's at, and it's going places. Trust me. All right. Sam Rogowski, I give a big Jim Acosta update here for you. I know you're going to want to hear this. So don't go anywhere. Back right after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam Majowski. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Sam Rejovsky, Sam Nation. You know, I need to give you an update on Michael Avenatti. I know that when he first came upon the scene and he was representing Stormy Daniels, I told you that that I thought this guy was cruising for a bruising. And that's because as an attorney, he was breaking all of the rules, right? He was giving the worst advice to his client. He clearly was profiting off of that. He was using his client for his own self-promotion. And I was looking at what he was doing, and I stripped away all the newsworthiness of it. I took away the obvious pass, I think, that he would get by virtue of taking a stand against Trump. And I thought, how would, for example, the California State Bar look at me as an attorney if I were doing this to some less famous client and fighting a less newsworthy fight? Or certainly a fight where there was less agreement on who the good guy was and who the bad guy was, right? And the answer is quite clear. I mean, the guy was cutting a corner. If I did that, I would get reprimanded and potentially suffer some sanctions by the state bar. Might get suspended, and in some cases might even lose my license. But it led me to think, well, if he's doing this, what else is he doing, right? So we now know, right, he was allegedly tried to blackmail Nike into giving him $10 million, $20 million. He also seems to have misled a client of his who was a mentally disabled paraplegic client about a $4 million settlement. So this is very basic bad lawyering stuff. You can't take your client's money, steal it, and then lie to them, of course, about the case not settling or whatnot. So it's just he's done. OK, I don't know how else to put it. I loved this segment, this little clip Shep Smith did. He roasted Avenatti on Wednesday. Listen to this.
Breaking news now on Fox News Channel. Michael Avenatti is going to start slumming it now as federal officials say they've just seized his $5 million jet. The attorney's now facing charges of extortion in New York City and bank and wire fraud in Los Angeles. Says he's innocent, could face decades behind bars. Here's the most interesting part of the jet. The plane is known to be registered to, and I quote, Passport 420. Passport meaning a way to get around, potentially. 420 often meaning, weed. But we don't know in this case. We do know that trips between CNN and MSNBC will now require an Uber, as the jet is no more.
So he's lost his plane, and even Shep Smith, the dry man over at Fox News, is having a field day with it. Okay. TV News hosted Michael Avenatti 254 times in 1 year, so you can see the kind of promotion, self-promotion that Avenatti got. And they didn't. Nobody at CNN, nobody at MSNBC cared that this guy was a tool, that everybody knew he was a tool, that he was a shady lawyer. All they cared about was his takedown of Trump. And the takeaway here, too, is this is why, by the way, the entire investigation and into potential spying and abuse of investigatory powers by various agencies into the Trump campaign, why this story is so fertile, in my view, is because these allegedly smart, allegedly dispassionate stewards of the law, they all threw all the rules out the window. And they did it. They did it the same way Avenatti did, the same way CNN did, the same way MSNBC did. Why? Because Trump was so obviously, to all of us, right, obviously underqualified at being president. He was never meant to be. We had to do everything we could to stop this guy from becoming president, stepping foot in the White House. So desperate times call for what? Desperate measure. And of course, when the ends justify the means, then, you know, nothing good happens. Well, I'll also give you one other update here, and this is not from The Onion. This is from The Daily Caller. The New York Press Club announced that Jim Acosta will receive the Truth to Power Award. I think I coughed up a Catstro hairball just there. We are proud to honor a man such as Jim Acosta, who has proven himself throughout his storied decades-long career to be a journalist of the utmost integrity, Jane Tillman Irving, president of the press club, said in the release. Quote, for his unwavering commitment to fact and journalism, we are pleased to add to Jim's many accolades with this Gabe Pressman Truth to Power Award. You know what? He can get as many awards from his left-wing cronies as he wants. He's still going to be a joke in the footnote of history. Sam Rogowski, thanks for being with us today. I'll be back here next week. I think we're going to get back on our Thursday-Friday schedule here now for a little while. I will be back into a more regular, steady routine. Have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy time with your loved ones. Thank you for following the program. And as always, reach out to me on Twitter, at Sam Nation, and my email, sam@samnation.com. Have a great weekend, folks. Talk to you later. Keep up.